When T.S. Eliot wrote, "April is the cruelest month," I doubt he ever imagined it would someday be named National Poetry Month. Today, as part of that celebration, a new edition of the Oxford Book of American Poetry is being released, revised for the first time in 30 years. And joining us now are its editor, David Lehman, and two poets, Natasha Trethewey, whose newest collection, Native Guard, is published by Houghton Mifflin, and David Tucker, author of Late for Work, which is published by Mariner Originals. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all to the show. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Great to be back.
When poets talk normally, they talk normally, right? I mean, your mind is not ever... are you able to separate that process in your head, or do you suddenly find yourself being metaphorical? Natasha, do you have to fight off the metaphors and the similes?
I don't think I do. We were just having a conversation about how poets need to try to also be ordinary sometimes. I don't think it's so much of an effort to not think in metaphor all the time, which is why writing poems is great, because that's when you turn that ordinary speech into more sacred speech.
And David Tucker, you work at a newspaper, the New York Star Ledger, don't you?
I do.
So you have to be fluent in two kinds of writing, at least.
Well, somewhat. I mean, there are some wonderful similarities between good journalism and good poetry, but there are a lot of differences as well. They both depend on, very often, on quickness of language, a spareness of writing, a kind of an efficiency. And I think that good journalists have a lot of poet in them.
David Lehman, how significant are the revisions in the Oxford Book of American Poetry to the current poetry world? I mean, will poets understand why you made some of the changes you've made?
Well, yes, I hope they will. Of course, they will discuss, and there'll be debate and discussion. There always is in the poetry world, as you know.
Some crushed egos, too, I'm sure.
Well, not everyone can be included, even in a book that aspires to be Catholic and inclusive and comprehensive and quite aware of the ways in which our sense of the canon has changed and been enlarged since 1976.
Was anyone in the previous edition cut out?
I think we cut 6 or 7 poets from the previous edition. So I'm aware of all the continuities between my book and F.O. Matheson's great book of 1950 and Richard Ellman's of 1976. There are continuities, even as there is disjunction as well.
Does the publication of a book like this create the same kind of controversy as, say, the Whitney Biennial does in the world of visual arts?
Well, let's see. It's hard to say because the book is just being published. I'm as curious as you are, and perhaps even more so, to see how the book will be received. It will be foolish to expect universal acclaim, although, of course, I believe it deserves that.
Well, things have changed, haven't they? There was Emily Dickinson was advised at one time when she sent her poems out not to publish. It isn't as difficult for a poet today, is it?
Well, I think because of the internet and the proliferation of magazines, you can post a poem or publish a poem and with greater speed than ever was the case previously. As you know, I edit the Best American Poetry annual anthology, and I read a great many magazines, and it seems to me that there are more poets and more closet poets in America today than perhaps ever before, and I can't see that as being anything but a good thing.
So, but at the same time, we're told, Natasha, that fewer and fewer people are publishing poetry and reading poetry. So is it more the self-publishing of the internet, or do you find that there are plenty of places you can send your work to?
I think there are a lot of places to send work to. I mean, yes, people are publishing quickly, as David said, on the internet, and people having an audience who might not have ever had people actually reading their poems. But there's lots of small journals, too, smaller and larger journals that poets can send work to. And I think because of the other sort of formats that we can get poetry, that there are listeners even. There are audio journals that publish poetry. So I think that there are maybe not as many readers, but certainly a lot more listeners.
May I say one more thing, which is I believe that if we present poetry in an attractive way, we'll reach readers who do exist. We have 30,000 readers for Best American Poetry each year, which is a drop in the bucket next to the Academy Awards, but it's significant in the way that jazz is significant. In the Oxford Book of American Poetry, we have 210 poets, and I wrote a headnote for each and tried to make that a kind of form, the way a sonnet consisting of 14 lines is a form, to tell an anecdote or orient the reader just enough so that he or she will get a purchase on the poet. And I think that's the kind of feature that helps a book reach a real audience.
Mm-hmm. You know,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I can't cite you any figures exactly, but my impression is that rather than there being fewer poetry readers, there are a lot more than there used to be. I think, you know, for example, Ted Kooser, poet laureate, has a weekly column which he introduces a poem, and that can be downloaded by newspapers.
Now we have Garrison Keillor doing it on public radio.
Right, and he boasts a circulation, something I'm into, of 10 million readers. And I think the Internet has had a tremendous impact, not only because it's a kind of instant publication, but anyone can tap into what's out there, even including poets. And the world of American poetry right now is so vigorous and so varied, with so many different kinds of writers working. I think there probably are a lot more readers.
Although when someone like Garrison Keillor is considering what poems to include, I'm sure he is thinking accessible quality, but also accessible. And some poetry just isn't all that accessible.
I think more poetry is accessible than one may assume. That is, the most notoriously difficult poet in America is probably John Ashbery. Yet he has a tremendous number of fans. We had a three-day festival honoring John Ashbery's poetry last week at the New School, and our auditorium holds more than 600, and there was standing room only. So something must be gotten. I believe that enjoyment of poetry precedes comprehension.
Mm-hmm. Well, in his case, he writes personal things that only he and perhaps the person he's writing about will even understand. So what is the responsibility of a poet? To just write whatever occurs to him or her?
I don't think a poet has a social responsibility other than to impart pleasure to the reader and to celebrate creation and existence. I think those are the first and fundamental things. Wordsworth said that the chief criterion in judging poetry is, does it give pleasure? And I think that's paramount and true.
My guess... go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think to an extent, this idea that there are a lot of inaccessible poets it's a bit of a myth. I mean, there are poets who you kind of have to go and get them. They are a little more difficult than others. But I can't imagine Wallace Stevens has ever been more popular than he is right now. And, you know, Wallace Stevens, despite part of the myth it may surround him for readers who are not familiar with him, once you hang with a few Wallace Stevens poems, you get it, and then the adventure begins. Mm-hmm.
My guests are David Tucker, whose book is Late for Work, Poems with a Foreword by Philip Levine, not a bad poet in his own right, Natasha Trethewey, whose book is Native Guard Poems, and David Lieben is here, who's chosen and edited the latest edition of the Oxford Book of American Poetry, obviously from Oxford University Press. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. We mentioned Wallace Stevens. There are some givens, I'm sure, when you work on a book like this. There's always going to be Walt Whitman. There's always going to be William Carlos Williams and Frost and Eliot I guess Marianne Moore we would expect automatically, Elizabeth Bishop. But what happens when you go over those poems and look at the ones that were in previous editions? Did you find that some of them felt a little stale and that you needed to bring in other poems that are perhaps less well known?
I did feel that I could represent William Carlos Williams and Robert Frost and Elizabeth Bishop, in particular of the poets you mentioned, in a better way than was previously the case. And I did feel also that one should not only revise the existing canon so that whereas there were 78 poets in 1976, there are 210 today. But one should go over all of the selections and make sure that you are representing them at their best.
Well, let's listen to something from Elizabeth Bishop, read by, I think, Elizabeth Bishop.
I caught a tremendous fish and held him beside the boat half out of water with my hook fast in the corner of his mouth. He didn't fight. He hadn't fought at all. He hung a grunting weight, battered and venerable and homely. Here and there, his brown skin hung in strips like ancient wallpaper, and its pattern of darker brown was like wallpaper. Shapes like full-blown roses, stained and lost through age. He was speckled with barnacles, fine rosettes of lime, and infested with tiny white sea lice, and underneath two or three rags of green weed hung down. While his gills were breathing in the terrible oxygen, frightening gills, fresh and crisp with blood that can cut so badly, I thought of the coarse white flesh packed in like feathers, the big bones and the little bones, the dramatic reds and blacks of his shiny entrails, and the pink swim bladder like a big peony. I looked into his eyes, which were far larger than mine, but shallower and yellowed, the irises backed and packed with tarnished tinfoil seen through lenses of old scratched isinglass. They shifted a little, but not to return my stare. It was more like the tipping of an object toward the light. I admired his sullen face, the mechanism of his jaw, and then I saw that from his lower lip, if you could call it a lip, grim, wet, and weapon-like, hung five old pieces of fish line, or four, and a wire leader with the swivel still attached, with all their five big hooks grown firmly in his mouth. A green line, frayed at the end where he broke it, two heavier lines, and a fine black thread still crimped from the strain and snap when it broke and he got away. Like medals with their ribbons frayed and wavering, the five-haired beard of wisdom trailing from his aching jaw. I stared and stared, and victory filled up the little rented boat. From the pool of bilge, where oil had spread a rainbow around the rusted engine, to the baler rusted orange, the sun-cracked thwarts, the oarlocks on their strings, the gunnels, until everything was rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. And I let the fish go.
And that was Elizabeth Bishop from a recording called Poetry on Record, a CD and book that was recently published by Shout Factory. Listening to her read, do you think that it's good to hear poets read their own work? Because some poets do actually guide us into understanding poems, and others read in a way that is so, I don't know what word to use, so affectless that it almost undermines the power of the words.
Well, you're right, and some poets are better at reading their work than others are, but you always learn something about the poetry and the poet by the manner in which they present themselves. And also, the poetry reading has become an institution in America and the place where people get their poetry and where you're likely to sell poetry books and sign them afterwards.
Is that something you think about, Natasha, how you're going to read a poem?
Yes, I do think about that a lot. And I agree with David. I find that people often come up after readings and talk about, having engaged with the poems themselves on the page and then what it means to hear me read them or hear another poet read them. And I take very seriously the performance, the reading of the poem for even my own accent, my own emphasis on certain places in the poem that I hope exists, of course, in the lineation of the poem, but I know that there's always something else that my presence adds to it.
Well, actually, we've gotten to a point now where poetry on a very popular level is show business with the poetry slams. There was even a Broadway show of poetry slams. But I guess I doubt that any of those poems would ever make it into the Oxford Book of American Poetry.
Well, you never know. It seems to me that if there's an expansion and a boom in poetry writing, you will have a lot of bad poetry being written. But I think bad poetry may be good for poetry in general, mm-hmm. because it will interest and inspire a lot of people to write poetry.
So someone like Rod McKeown, I don't mean to suggest you're a bad poet, but somebody like him writing a bestseller would have drawn a lot of readers to poetry, and then they might have discovered somebody else.
Well, I give a counterexample of Billy Collins, who's a serious poet and I think a much more substantial one, obviously, than Rod McKeown, and he's extraordinarily popular. He may be the most popular American poet since Robert Frost. His work has been read aloud by himself, by Garrison Keillor, whom you referred to earlier. And the fact that so many people buy his books and read them is a really interesting fact. That is, you can coerce people to do a lot of things, but buy a book of poetry isn't one of them.
David, do you practice reading them before you get out there, or do you just trust that the experience will get you to read it well?
No, I don't trust the experience. I do read beforehand, and I never quite seem to read a poem the same way each time. In a small way, I think the act of reading a poem, Mary Oliver has pointed out that it's a form of publication. And although the writing of poetry is the abiding mystery, reading of poetry as well, I think you tend to, I'll read a poem sometimes and I'll be a half a beat behind or ahead with the way I read it last time. And you can discover things about your own work by reading it at times.
Houghton Mifflin, Natasha's publisher, has just launched The Poetic Voice, a podcast series of the poets they publish reading their own work, which could be found at iTunes, Yahoo, and other podcast directories. So we're starting to hear poets read more, and I wonder whether that isn't the ideal. Later we'll listen to a little Walt Whitman. I'm not sure he was the best reader of his own work.
I happen to love reading my own work aloud, and I also love reading the work of the poets I admire out loud. And as an
you mean just at home?
Well, yes, for the sake of my wife or a friend, but also I teach, and I have my students memorize a poem every week and recite that poem, and I find that this is a great way to teach, and it's a great way for people to possess a poem.
But there was a time, I know when I went to school, where we were forced to memorize poems, usually kind of doggerel poems, but still poems, and that is gone. I know people who can recite whole books of Wordsworth poems, pretty great poet. That's totally lost, isn't it?
Well it's coming back.
Yeah, I think it is beginning to come back, and I think the NEA is actually has a program in the schools mm-hmm. now.
Poetry Out Loud.
Poetry Out Loud, encouraging students to memorize poetry. I didn't grow up in a time when poetry was memorized, but my father did. And
I'm older than you, David.
I got turned on to poetry by my father. Was a construction worker. He drove a bulldozer, but he retained every line of Shakespeare that he was forced to memorize in high school. So it wasn't uncommon to have him taking off his muddy work boots at night and reciting Julius Caesar's speech about Cassius.
My guests are David Tucker, who is the winner of the 2005 Catherine Bakeless Nason Prize for Poetry. His latest collection, Late for Work, is published by Mariner Books. Natasha Trethewey, I'm sorry, Natasha, I'm not... Oh, here it is. How many books have you published so far?
This is the third.
And the winner of the Cave Canem Poetry Prize, her latest, Native Guard Poems, and David Lehman, author of how many volumes, David? Any number of your own.
Six books of poetry and...
Editing.
Many anthologies and five books of critical prose.
And now the updated, the Oxford Book of American Poetry, chosen and edited by David Lehman and published by Oxford University Press. We will continue our conversation after this.
America, center of equal daughters, equal sons, all alike and dear, grown, ungrown, young or old, strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable, rich, perennial with the earth, with freedom, law, and love.
Walt Whitman reading his own work. We're celebrating Poetry Month, which we do, by the way, every Friday as well, when we broadcast a poem that has been put together for a new series. Last week it was C.K. Williams. David Lehman is here. He's chosen and edited the revised version of the Oxford Book of American Poetry, published by Oxford University Press. Natasha Threthway, whose book is Native Guard, and David Tucker, Late for Work. And let's talk about Whitman for a moment, because one of the things we wanted to talk about was what makes American poetry American. Is he really the beginning of it, or do we see signs before him?
Well, there are signs, and there are, in many ways, Emerson is the prophet in the wilderness calling for the existence of Whitman, and Whitman arrives as the fulfillment of this dream Emerson has of American poetry as an entity in its own right rather than as a tributary of a British-centric river.
But since Leaves of Grass went through so many different editions and he changed it so much, which versions do you wind up going to when you're putting them in an anthology?
Well, that's a fascinating editorial question that I had to face. I chose the 1855 edition of Song of Myself. That's the first edition. It's the one he printed privately, and actually he reviewed it himself.
Before he started censoring himself.
And before he started adding lines to it. And I think it's the superior version. It's the one that got Ralph Waldo Emerson to write him the greatest fan letter any poet ever received. Mm-hmm. I greet you at the beginning of a great career. And he describes himself as Walt Whitman, a rough. No, Walt Whitman, an American. One of the roughs, a cosmos. And that's much better than the later version, which is Walt Whitman of Manhattan, the sun, a cosmos. Is not anywhere near the quality of Walt Whitman, an American, one of the roughs, a cosmos.
Is it possible to write American poetry, write poetry in this country, without having read a lot of Whitman, Natasha?
Well, I think, you know, somebody said for every one poem you write, you should have read 100. So I don't know if it's, I think the more we know, the better we write. And to really write those American poems, those diverse, expansive, inclusive American poems, it means that our own reading has been diverse, expansive, and inclusive.
And were there, are there some who have has particular significance for you?
Oh, goodness. Of Whitman's poems.
I don't mean Whitman in general. I just mean poets who suddenly light bulbs went off and you realized you could do things you might not have realized you could do.
I think that's always changing for me. But Elizabeth Bishop was one of those people for me at some point.
Now, the Elizabeth Bishop poem we heard is not included in the Oxford anthology.
You have to make some difficult choices. And Elizabeth Bishop gets 21 pages, which is really major treatment. I think one of her greatest poems is called Over 2,000 Illustrations and a Complete Concordance. And another is At the Fish Houses. And there's one, a villanelle called One Art. And there's a poem called Crusoe in England. And there's one called In the Waiting Room. Now, some of these poems were not available in 1976 because she was still alive when Richard Ellman was preparing that edition. So you have more of her life to represent. And you have greater critical distance. I included both of her Sistinas. And let the reader decide which is the better one.
David, are there poets who influence you more than others?
Well, there are poets that I read more than others. And there are, I mean, to answer the question about Whitman, I think Whitman is one of those poets like, you know, like Shakespeare. I mean, I think the answer is you can't really write poetry seriously if you don't read Walt Whitman and read him seriously. And there are poets that are like sunshine. You have to, or like air. You have to go there and you have to study them.
And you have to come to grips with them.
Yes, yes. And there are others that are just indispensable. How much they end up influencing your work is another one of those things that is hard for the individual poet, I think, to recognize. You're so far in, hopefully, inside your own work. But Stevens is absolutely another. And you're also influenced by the general cacophony of contemporary poets, which right now is rich and various.
Would you read something for us?
Sure.
Leafing through pages right
there.
There
we go. This poem is called "And This Just In." It's really a newspaper poem, or I guess it's an anti-newspaper poem. It's sort of my imaginary newspaper. Those footfalls on the stairs when the night shift went home, the sunlight fanning through the dinosaur's rib cage, the janitor's sneeze. We're asking questions. We'd like to know more. The moth in the clock tower at City Hall, the 200th generation to sleep there. We may banner that story across page one. And in Metro, we're leading with the yawn that traveled city council chambers this morning, then slipped into the streets and wound through the city. The editorial page will decry the unaccountable boredom that overtook everyone around 3 p.m. Features praises the slowness of moonlight, making its way around the house, staying an hour in each chair, and the inertia of calendars not turned since winter. A watchman humming in the parking lot at Broad and Market, we have that, with a sidebar and the bronze glass of a whiskey bottle cracking into cheap jewels under his boots. A boy walking across the ball field an hour after the game. We're covering that silence. We have reporters working hard. We're getting to the bottom of it all.
Michael Tucker reading one of the poems from his new collection, Late for Work, published by Mariner Books. Natasha, as long as we're reading poetry, what do you have for us?
Oh, I'd be happy to. This is a blues sonnet. Graveyard Blues. It rained the whole time we were laying her down. Rained from church to grave when we put her down. The suck of mud at our feet was a hollow sound. When the preacher called out, I held up my hand. When he called for a witness, I raised my hand. Death stops the body's work, the soul's a journeyman. The sun came out when I turned to walk away, glared down on me as I turned and walked away, my back to my mother, leaving her where she lay. The road going home was pocked with holes. That home-going road's always full of holes. Though we slow down, time's wheel still rolls. I wander now among names of the dead. My mother's name, stone pillow for my head.
And that was Natasha Trethewey reading from her new collection, Native Guard. We don't, in Natasha's case, rhyme was a factor. Elizabeth Bishop also loved rhyme. Some poets in the Whitman tradition have completely gotten rid of it. How do you decide whether you're going to rhyme or not?
Well, the hope for me, and I think this is what really happened in writing this book, is that the poems suggested to me what kind of formal elements they needed. And so, like the blues sonnet I just read, there are many poems in traditional forms that have repeating elements. And that was for me because I knew that both the rhyme, the way that it helps us remember, when I was trying to reinscribe things that had been forgotten from our cultural memory, it seemed that rhyme and the repeating form was the way to do that.
And in the blues, you have the same word repeated for the first two lines and then a rhyme in the third line.
Right.
Now, David, you could read for any of the poems from the Oxford Book of American Poetry that you've edited, but I've asked you to read one of your own.
Well, thank you for that. I'm going to read a very short poem from my book, When a Woman Loves a Man. It's called Radio. And instead of rhyme, what I did was limit myself to three words per line over the course of 14 lines. And since we're doing a radio show,
it's appropriate.
Radio. I left it on when I left the house for the pleasure of coming back 10 hours later to the greatness of Teddy Wilson, After You've Gone, on the piano in the corner of the bedroom as I enter in the dark.
That's about surprise as much as anything.
Well, I also wanted to capture the experience of walking into that room in the dark and hearing Teddy Wilson, After You've Gone, one of the great jazz songs. It was this great, wonderful moment.
Well, it's interesting that the only musician you've included in this is Bob Dylan. I could see, if we're starting to think about people who wrote song lyrics, Cole Porter or Ira Gershwin.
Well, we have Bessie Smith. We have Bessie Smith and Robert Johnson as well as Bob Dylan.
Uh-huh.
I love lyrics, and I would love to do a whole book of Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, Lawrence Hart, Oscar Hammerstein, Johnny Mercer, Lawrence Hart, I've already mentioned, Sammy Kahn. I mean, these are the greats. I think that's a different genre.
But do you think of Dylan? Because some people used to say Dylan was the greatest American poet since W.H. Auden, and I thought that was a bit of a stretch. But do you think that his lyrics are poetry, or are they just very sophisticated song lyrics?
Well, I think so many aggressive claims have been advanced in defense of Bob Dylan that it made sense to go over his work, and I think his best period was the mid-60s, and to pick the work that I thought the best, which is Desolation Row, which makes a very cunning reference to T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound. And I thought I would situate Bob Dylan's Desolation Row among his contemporaries, be they Billy Collins and Robert Pinsky or Sharon Olds and Louise Glück. Let the reader see how he measures up.
Some poets who have been left out include Leroy Jones, now a Mary Baraka. Is he, has his time passed, you think?
Do you miss his work?
Well, that's not the question. Sometimes people are considered important for a time, and I'm just asking you, what is the thinking there? I know much was made of the fact that you included poets born after 1935 in this collection, but even that struck me as being something that we could talk about, because in the 1976 edition, a poet born in 1935 was 41. Your youngest poet was born in 1950. So the youngest poet in the collection is 56.
1950 was a very good year for poets.
a lot of good 56-year-old poets.
A lot of very good poets were born in that year in particular. And it happens to be the midpoint of the century, and also the year that Matheson's anthology came out. As you approach the present, your judgment necessarily becomes less certain, perhaps more provocative, and you do have to have a line of demarcation somewhere. So I picked 1950, and one task I wanted to do was to broaden our sense of the past. That is, in 1976, you had no Emma Lazarus, though she's a much more substantial poet than people realize, or Edna St. Vincent Millay, who had been punished for being young and famous or young and promiscuous. You had no Charles Bukowski, who was considered, you know, infra, you know, beneath the dignity of poetry. But now I think we can hear what artistry went into those poems of Charles Bukowski, or Charles Reznikov and the Objectivist poets are completely overlooked in the past.
But you've also included Clement Moore's Visit from St. Nicholas.
Well, I think that it's wise these days to assume that no one really knows or possesses anything, and you'd be doing people a service to publish Paul Revere's Ride of Longfellow, let's say, or Clement Moore, or Casey at the Bat, or Emma Lazarus's The New Colossus, because those are really important parts of our national and cultural heritage.
Will there be another 30 years before we see a new revision of the Oxford Guide to American
Poetry? I hope so, because that would confirm that I've made judicious selections.
Well, let's hope. And how old will you be when? I'm not going to ask you either of you that.
They're going to be in Best American Poetry. And Natasha has been in Best American Poetry at least twice.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And David Tucker's time will come. This is your first book, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
But very well received, so you must be very pleased. Have you been writing poetry all these years and
kept it
in a drawer? And
no, I've been hammering away at it steadily, but probably more in earnest the last 5 or 6 years. I'd just like to say about David's anthology, I agree about Bob Dylan. I think Desolation Row is a poem, although I think a lot of Bob Dylan is more poetic than poetry. It has wonderful flashes. And I would argue with him about, you can nitpick anything, but I think Leroy Jones, I would have included him, especially his early work.
David Tucker and Natasha Trethewey will be taking part at a National Poetry Month reading tonight at 7 o'clock at Poets House. That's at 72 Spring Street. David Lehman has many readings throughout May, and you can find details of them on our show page at wnyc.org. The books involved, Natasha Trethewey's Native Guard, David Tucker's Late for Work, and David Lehman has chosen and edited the Oxford Book of American Poetry, which is published by Oxford University Press, and is a heavy book. Is the last book as big as this?
No, but it's a lot lighter if you're in it.
and usually it opens up to the page that your poems are on. Thank you all so much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.